Okay, so I'm based in Vienna in Austria, and I'm part of the Big Sibling Collective, which is a small collective that formed about a year and a half ago. And we're mainly working against racist police violence. So we're a group of white people and persons of colors, sort of a mixed racial group. And we're doing workshops, sort of educational programs that we're starting off right now. We've done the first one, I think, 2 weeks ago. And now we're trying to expand that also to sort of work with younger people and work with different target groups. And then also we've started these interviews or sort of these podcasts that I'd like to do with you today, where we talk to just all kinds of people around topics of racism, racist police violence, racial profiling, empowerment, sort of all kinds of topics that come into play with what we're doing. And then we have a recording that we put on our website, and now we're about to register also for, I don't know, Audible or some like podcast thing. We haven't figured that out quite. And then we transcribe it, and then also translate it. So there's always a German and English version. Yeah,
Nice.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah,
That's sort
that.
of some of the main things that we've started off doing.
Oh, that sounds really cool. We get to do that.
So, thanks to the two of you for being here with me today. You both are organized with the campaign to fight toxic prisons in the United States, right?
FTP.
FTP,
Yep. FTP and
also
AFEP,
short
I believe.
for
Yeah.
Free the People, Fire
Yep.
Prisons,
Yep.
maybe
Fuck the
Fuck the
Police.
Police. Yeah, all of those.
Very useful abbreviation. So maybe you can tell me something a little bit about yourselves, what you deal with, and about the campaign to fight toxic prisons. Would be nice to start with.
You want to start, Richard?
Sure. Well, actually, Jordan, it's better if you start because you can give the history better than me, and then I'll
Okay.
just say some of the recent stuff or whatever. So.
Okay. Yeah, my name is Jordan Mazurek. They, them. I am one of the co-founders of Fight Toxic Prisons. We've been organizing since about 2015, 2016 or so, working at the intersections of environmental justice and abolition. Our organizing work got started from a history of, radical environmental organizing coming out of Earth First, the Earth Liberation Front, Animal Liberation Front. In the early 2000s, right after 9/11, and the Patriot Act got passed, the FBI was handed massive extensions of powers to criminalize activists and organizers, and they decided to focus this energy and these newfound powers on the radical environmental movement. So a lot of folks that were doing nonviolent direct action and stuff like that started getting terrorist enhancements on top of their sentences in what's called the FBI's quote unquote Green Scare. And so a ton of radical environmental activists started going to prison, and as such, also started analyzing environmentally the state of prisons, right? And so our organizing comes out of that, comes out of, was inspired by communications between Earth First support organizers and stuff like that with the folks inside the prisons, right? And so we, the first ideas came directly from letters, and so we realized that there's, a massive gap. A lot of times movements become siloed for various reasons, and the environmental movement within itself has multiple different silos between, mainstream environmentalism, radical environmentalism, and environmental justice work. And because of those silos, like, we're really missing a massive opportunity to organize and build lines of solidarity between movements. And so that's really been the focus of our work over the past few years, past number of years, really since we got started, was being like, okay, the prison is a very powerful nexus around which we can gather to fight, because it intersects so many different lines of struggle. from the criminalization of Black, Brown, Indigenous, poor folks to the criminalization of our organizers and activists on the front lines, right? Fighting in various different struggles. The state uses the cops, uses the prison systems to criminalize dissent and criminalize our communities, right? And so we were like, okay, let's start bringing folks together around this nexus between environmental activism and organizing and struggles for the abolition of the prison industrial complex. And out of that, it's been pretty exciting because we have gotten to break down those silos between a number of different struggles and have collaboration around learning the tactics, learning the strategies, learning so much from each of these different movements and allowing the creation of space for folks to come together organically, naturally, to really begin to build, like I was saying, those lines of solidarity.
So would you say that sort of this intersection between environmental justice and prison abolition came as a reaction to police strategies? So that as a lot of people were incarcerated, that you were reacting to that and sort of out of that built something new and broke down those silos?
Yeah, I would say it definitely came as sort of an outcropping of the repression in the early 2000s against the radical environmental movement. But the problem is, there's a number of different silos, like I was saying, within environmentalism in the US. So mainstream environmentalism, historically, very liberal, very middle class, upper class, white base, mostly focused around, arguably mundane things, recycling, preservation of nature, divorced from a political analysis around racial or class struggle, right? It's just like, oh, we need to save the planet, and that's the extent of my analysis. Versus radical environmentalism and the environmental justice movement, right? So radical environmentalism also, for a long part of its history in the US, has been extremely white, but coming from a political analysis that is critiquing of capitalism, critiquing of white supremacy, and pursuing actions and tactics that are, more in alignment with different like anarcho-communist struggles, et cetera. That being said, there's been a concerted effort within the radical environmental movement over the past 2 decades to really start rooting out the sort of white supremacy, the misogyny within the movement itself, and developing an analysis of settler colonialism. And the movement as a result now is much less white, much more widespread, and engaged in various frontline struggles from deportation fights to, running support work for BLM activists on the ground. Like a lot of the direct action tactics and trainings we've seen across the country being utilized in various movements has come from the radical environmental movement and its sort of internal commitment to address the white supremacy, like I was saying, misogyny, et cetera, within that movement. The environmental justice movement, the third sort of siloed big group, is really a bunch of different thousands of grassroots campaigns that crop up, mostly in Black, Brown, Indigenous communities, right? And this, our comrade David Pello, out of UC Santa Barbara, he's one of the good organizers, good activists, good scholar. And we sort of resonate with a lot of his critique of the environmental justice movement in that, yes, it is a lot of these struggles are being organized by frontline communities, but they're being organized within capitalism, within the existing status quo. They're not challenging it, they're seeking for the existing structures in place to, stop the toxic waste. They're not. To stop, factory coming in or something like that. It's capitulation to the status quo in hopes that the status quo will, stop poisoning people. So there's not necessarily as deep-rooted and analysis of capitalism and analysis of white supremacy. And as such, the politics tend to be, you know, a bit liberal and reformist, et cetera. So our work over the past number of years has been to really like bridge the gaps between the radical environmental and the environmental justice movements, along with the broader abolition movement, and one, begin developing those lines of analysis, but also two, begin to develop, you know, camaraderie, the ability to work together, to organize together, to learn from each other, and to build, you know, keep saying lines of solidarity, I keep repeating myself, but across geographic space, across community spaces, across people that, because of capitalism, settler colonialism, white supremacy, patriarchy, like, it's all designed to keep us divided, to keep us from learning from each other, because when we learn from each other, that's when we're truly dangerous to the system as it exists, right?
And Richard, can I ask you if you'd like to sort of introduce yourself briefly and how you started organizing maybe with FTP?
Yeah, sure. I'm Richard, he, him pronouns. I've been organizing with Fight Toxic Prisons for the past couple of years. And prior to that, like, Jordan's the person who got me into actually organizing with Fight Toxic Prisons, mainly out of like deep, like, as I talk to folks about it now, it's out of like an intensified understanding of the interconnectedness of like liberation struggles, specifically Black liberation struggles, with other, like, with the environmental movements and with other things like that. Because one thing that I really try and connect with folks now about is that the abolitionist struggle, in terms of prisons, is not a new movement, and that it's literally the continuation of abolitionist struggles that have been going on for the past 300 to 400 years. And as we continue to work and organize around abolition, we do it with respect to like those previous organizers and those previous folks who were part of the movement, but also knowing and understanding, as Jordan was articulating, the interconnectedness between white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, all those different things help to merely transform what it means to be an abolitionist in the current context. And that's a major part of what Fight Toxic Prisons' work is just to kind of like deconstruct the heteropatriarchal structures and ideologies that tend to separate like abolition movement as strictly about the abolition of prisons. So like as Fight Toxic Prisons, as we've continued to develop our campaign work over the past couple of years, we try to develop like deep solidarity between with incarcerated folks, but also with those communities. And part of that is like creating a strong sense of accountability within all those spaces. And that kind of helps us propel the work that we're doing. So that's kind of just like a brief introduction to me and kind of like how I kind of see what like we're doing with Fight Toxic Prisons.
Thank you for that. One of the words that you've quite often both said right now is abolition and prison abolition. And it would be really cool for me if you could sort of define what that means for you. Because in the Austrian context, that's a word that's, I think, not as often used as maybe in the US context. There are some groups like the Anarchist Black Cross that talk a lot about abolition, but in general, it's not that widely known, and I don't think it has sort of the same historical context. So if you could say something about that, what it means, and why you refer to that so much.
So abolition, specifically in the United States context, like one of the things that a lot of people are aware of is like the problem of mass incarceration. It doesn't necessarily, that doesn't necessarily happen globally, but that's kind of been a lot of people's introduction into what the prison system is, the fact that we incarcerate so many people. But like As White Toxic Prison, as we start to define abolition, it goes beyond like mass incarceration or the private prison industrial complex. Our understanding of abolition is the entire system that creates the need for incarceration to begin with. So it would be the policing, it would be prisons themselves, it would be detention centers, it would be laws and policies that regulate policing. So it encompasses a much wider range of it encompasses a much wider range of things than just prisons themselves. Although like we do explicitly work at like we do explicitly work at abolishing prisons themselves under like the idea, and Jordan's done a lot of Jordan did their PhD research in this area, and they continue to like grow an analysis on this, on the abolishing prisons under the idea of their toxicity and harmfulness to the environment. Except when we think about the environment, we try and create a much more nuanced understanding of what all those things mean. And I'll let like Jordan, I'll let you have your, and you can say what I was going to say about that way better than me, so I'll let you.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just thinking about abolition and like what you were saying. So I think a big part of it is like Richard was saying earlier, we're situating ourselves as abolitionists within a 400-year struggle, right, against slavery and, against the punitive aspects of the state, right? Courts, policing, prisons, jails, like all these forms of control weaponized against our communities and our peoples. That's what we're fighting, right, as abolitionists. And I think, when you really get down to it, it's also when you take away the punitive components of a state, I don't think the state exists anymore, so we're also fighting the state, right?
Act.
And in so doing, abolition, there's the dynamic of destruction and creation that we're constantly going back and forth with, right? So one, we do want to destroy the system as it exists, but the abolitionist vision is not complete with just destruction, right? The whole point of abolition, echoing, oh, my brain's not working, Angela Davis, right? The whole point of abolition is not destruction, but the creation of a society in which we don't need to rely on police, we don't need to rely on prisons, in which we can solve harm and solve the problems within our community by our community, right? And so, what would the world, a world, an abolitionist world look like? It would look like having access to food, having access to housing, having access to healthcare, therapy, like all the things we know that reduce harm is what we need to be working on building in the here and now outside of the carceral punitive components of the state within our communities themselves that will make us more resilient, more vibrant in the long run. So, yeah. And then Richard was telling me to talk about the environmental toxicity aspects, right? Like just coming from an environmental angle from FTP, like we can consider the prisons and the carceral state as multiple types of toxic to our communities, right? It's socially toxic on the one hand. It's criminalizing Black, brown, poor, Indigenous folks and treating folks as disposable populations, right? This is sort of my own analysis, and people feel free to agree or disagree with me. But if we're looking at how like late stage neoliberal capitalism functions, it functions based off of the designation of entire populations as disposable. And so if you're disposable to capital, what are they going to do with you, right? They're either going to kill you or they're going to incarcerate you because you don't really serve a function to capital. And so we can see the growth of the prison industrial complex in the U.S. as a structural response by capital to the creation of these disposable populations under, like I was saying, late stage neoliberal capitalism. And if you're disposable, and we can see this in the mapping of environmental justice issues, right? If your community is disposable, nobody's going to care if your school is built next to a toxic waste dump. Nobody's going to care if people are dumping in your trash in your neighborhoods. It's like you aren't seen as human, right? You're reduced to a raw material within this ever grinding system. And if you're reduced to a raw material, then your community is going to get warehoused. Your community is going to get everything, the life and soul extracted from it as a means of population control, essentially. So this is also the reason, right, that we see prisons literally built on toxic land. Where do you put disposable people in disposable places? Where do you put people you label as toxic with the rest of the toxic stuff? So it's really defining people, entire communities as subhuman and treating them as such. So that's the socially toxic component, which leads to the environmentally toxic consequences. Like our comrade, Bryant Arroyo, he's locked up in Pennsylvania. There was an attempt to build a concrete factory right next to his prison, literally next door to the prison he's locked up at. And in the planning permit process, the permit said that no people lived in that entire area because the folks in the prison aren't considered people, right? And he was able to successfully organize like his entire prison from inside to intervene in that public planning process, and eventually forced that entire concrete factory was never built because he was able to get the city council or whatever to deny the permit. But it just sort of illustrates, right, that this is prison industrial complex, carceral state, it's literally just destructive to life. Anyway, you slice it.
Maybe you could tell me something a little bit about sort of the organizational structure of the campaign to fight toxic prisons, because now you said that you also organize with folks inside the prisons, which is kind of hard for me to like imagine, unfortunately, how this, like how you can put this into practice. So it would be good to know sort of how you organize, how the structure is. And I don't know, maybe some examples of campaigns that you're doing right now.
Yeah, I'll go first, Richie, and then you can fill in. So yeah, FTP, we organize from a place of solidarity, not charity. We're not here to save anybody. We're here to struggle alongside folks, in particularly those most directly impacted. The people currently inside prisons and jails are who we are accountable to. Because if we're not in communication and we're not accountable to them, we're screwing up, you know. We're not doing our due diligence to the movement. And so structurally, FTP is a collective. We have 8 core crew members spread across 7 states in the U.S., West Coast to East Coast. And each of us is sort of involved in whatever campaigns that we want to get involved in, whatever local organizing we want to get involved in. We have an agreement that we can do it under the banner of FTP. We don't really need to check in because, you know, we've developed that trust with each other. Like we know if one of us is going to throw down and put FTP's name on it, that they're throwing down for a good reason. And so as a result of that, we are actively involved in a number of ongoing campaigns. And because we're so spread out and have so much information available to us, we can really begin connecting people across the country to each other without even needing our involvement if they want to work on building something. And we can come back to each other for that support, right? Of, okay, I'm having trouble with this. I need to talk through this. Can we get your perspective? Do y'all have any resources over there that we can use? And part of that is, you know, long-term development of relationships within prisons with folks inside, you know, starting through letter writing, if you're lucky, phone calls, emails. Like, it's the 21st century. It's pretty easy to get in communication with folks inside in real time. Like at our Fight Toxic Prisons convergences, we have almost on every panel in real time, somebody inside on the panel with us, right? You can get them on a call. You can link the cell phone up to a speaker. Boom, you're good. Like the barriers between the inside and outside are massive, but not insurmountable. And because of that, we're able to check back in with our folks inside on the work that we're doing outside and get, you know, that feedback loop. Are we screwing up somewhere? Oh, we got one more FTP member joining. So yeah, are we screwing up somewhere? Is there a better strategy that we could use? Is there a more specific place we could focus pressure? We can, you know, get on the phone, get letter writing with folks inside to really hone in and develop those strategies. Yeah. Richard, you want to talk about any of the campaign work going on in Texas or how you do that?
Sure. I'll briefly talk about that, and I'll briefly talk about the hurricane work, and then, like, I want BP to kind of introduce themselves and give some idea on, like, their entryway into what we do with Fight Toxic Prisons. So, first, in Texas, like, one of the things that we've mentioned several times is, like, building group solidarity and empowering not only folks on the inside, but other grassroots movements to undertake the work for themselves, because abolitionist work, it's really hard for one, and for two, like, especially in like the United States, but more specifically in a place like Texas, there's not many of us, and there's a ginormous system that we're fighting against. So what I do in terms of organizing in Texas is that I've got a route in terms on what are the things that we focus on. And some of those things include improving the material conditions of currently incarcerated folks. And to that end, we work on stuff like getting air conditioning in all of the Texas prisons, because there's 136 prisons in Texas. 106 of them currently don't have any form of air conditioning at all. So that would be one way of, like, improving the material conditions. But we also work directly with incarcerated folks to, as Jordan mentioned, letter writing, even phone calls, because we've set up a phone line to get information on prison conditions through either loved ones who call in, and if we're lucky, we may have incarcerated folks call in as well to kind of give us, like, detailed information on what's happening in different facilities. Because one of the groups that we're in constant contact with is Jailhouse Lawyers, and they always and Jailhouse Lawyers is a group of incarcerated folks who advocate for themselves. And one of the things they always tell us, and one thing that we repeatedly tell to all of our comrades, is never trust anything that you hear from prison officials and prison administrators, because, like, they're going, as Jordan was mentioning, they're mainly concerned with profit, for one, and two, like, it's literally written in most of the work that they do that incarcerated folks are not human. So they're not concerned with the human existence of incarcerated folks. And then very briefly, I'll say one of the examples of campaign work that Jordan's been involved with, where that kind of exemplifies some of the work that we do with directly incarcerated folks, is our work with disaster response to hurricanes and things like that, and other natural but not so natural disasters. There's so some of the things that we do with that is, like, we engage in pressure campaigns and phone zaps based on the recommendations on what we get from currently incarcerated folks. And like it's a whole different conversation to talk about like the impact of COVID-19 on that. But generally, our communication with incarcerated folks guides the list of demands that we pressure prison officials and prison administrators into pursuing. So it might be a material need such as access to clean water and then evacuation procedures. That's probably the biggest thing that we tackle during hurricane season, because oftentimes like those things aren't accounted for. And Jordan can give some real details about like how disastrous those things have gone in certain areas. But just briefly, I would say that like our direct contact with incarcerated folks in those situations directly informs like not only our strategy and actions, but also how we organize with other folks around those same exact issues.
My name is BP, also known as Villainous. So I got started to be involved because, I'm an artist and an organizer. So I got involved after we started doing this Block the Juvie action in Seattle. Because what we were doing is we were like fighting against this juvie they're trying to build. We're using shows as a way to like protest and rally people, as well as being able to reach youth inside the juvie. And then I got invited to the FTP Convergence. And then from there, we kind of like ended up building. So I came and gave a talk basically as both a priorly incarcerated person, but also as an organizer. And we started getting involved, you know, together. I think I did the show as well where I rapped a little bit. And then I was like, yo, we need to build together. This is fly. It's like one of the flyest things I've seen. Like people talk about prison abolition, but this is like about it. And I'm with it. And so from that point, I just kind of got on with FTP. And done a lot of work. I know it's really quick, but I guess I could have drug out a little bit longer. But you know, kind of how it, you know, happened. I don't know if there's anything else I should touch on. Maybe the work we're doing now, I guess. Also including like as far as work we're like we've done is like that was dope to be a part of, with like things like being a part of bailouts and also helping do fundraisers and stuff like that, which is also awesome as an artist to be able to use your voice as well as your body. You know what I mean? Because I was an organizer and an artist like my pretty much whole adult, free adult life. So like, it's always amazing to be able to use them both together. And especially when we make really big impacts, from the bailouts to like FTP shutting down actual prisons to like a long list of things that I think I saw more productive than a lot of things. There's a lot of talk a lot of times, and then FTP was one of the first places that I saw like action, not to mention bringing people together with a convergence that wouldn't have been able to be brought together, that all have the shared experience or the shared mission. You know what I mean?
We get shit done.
Yeah. Jory and BP, did y'all want to talk about the solidarity tour?
Yeah. Yeah, we can. So the solidarity tour was a bunch of us going on tour. I don't want to do it all, so Jordan's going to have to help some of this, but and basically we're going down doing workshops from city to city, state to state, basically breaking down what FTP did, but also like what our goals are. Also like I had this, I also was able to bring little pieces too. Like we had this part about, the history of slavery to prison, how, prison is just slavery and how it came from slavery. And it never really was, it was like a smooth transition. It wasn't like, this is a separate thing that got made after. It was like, no, this is part of slavery. As well, we went into like what the basics of prison abolition, and the crowd. And then with one of our comrades from actually London, Kelsey, they went into like, you know, the cross sections of how like the incarcerated state does not help women specifically, which I don't want to speak to that. That's like they went hard with that, and I can't like take that space. But you know, I don't know if you want to say more, Jordan.
Yeah. To give context, this was a tour we did last summer, 2019 FTP Cutie Pox Southern Solidarity Tour coming at you. This was a tour we did directly after our convergence, and I realized we hadn't really discussed our convergences, but every year we do a convergence of 400 people or so, all from massively different grassroots frontline struggles, Black liberation, animal liberation, indigenous liberation, abolitionist, radical environmental, Like we get everybody and their mother together, sharing space in a way that, you know, there aren't really that many spaces where you just see so many different grassroots movements coming together to collaborate. And so we were like, okay, we need to like literally just create this space and bring people together in community for 4 or 5 days to really swap strategy, swap tactics, build relationships. Because at the end of the day, liberation is going to require us building those relationships and those like deep-rooted trust, you know? And so right after the convergence, you know, going from this perspective that, you know, liberation is going to require building those networks of trust, we did a 12-city tour throughout the entire South, the entire Southern U.S., from Georgia, Florida to Texas, because we like to go where the fight is, and we have an organizational commitment to building in the South. And yeah, we really treated it as like a first point of contact to really start building the relationships that now are growing even further into actual campaign work. Like right now, we're helping fight the construction of 3 new mega prisons in Alabama, for example. We're doing hurricane support work throughout the entire South, which is typically the most hard hit by hurricanes. We're building across Florida. We've got, yeah, just starting from that initial point of contact, really building long-term trust and movement work. And yeah, I think we forgot to mention sort of our biggest campaign victory, and what really got us started was a 5-year campaign that we coordinated with folks in Letcher County, Kentucky, the Letcher Governance Project, as well as a network of organizations across the country that were able to get together to shut down, spoiler alert, we won, shut down what would have been the most expensive federal prison in U.S. history, the $510 million maximum security prison that the federal government wanted to build on top of a mountaintop removal site, which is where they blow up the mountain to get the coal underneath, resulting in widespread environmental destruction as well as hyper concentration of heavy metals, arsenic, lead, poisonous materials into the land, into the waterways. They wanted to build a prison on top of this, a mile away from one of the last 3 old growth forests in the state. And after waging a 5-year campaign, which included a federal lawsuit with 21 federal prisoners, we were able to defeat it. And then we just kept going on and we're fighting all the others. So that's a big part of what we do as well, is fighting new prison construction and existing prisons, working to get them shut down.
Well, congratulations on that. That sounds like a long campaign, a lot of work, and a great victory. And maybe one thing that I think we haven't talked about so much is police, sort of police as an institution. If you could tell me a little bit about of sort of your analysis of police, what it means, maybe also taking the Black Lives Matter movement now into account. It would be super interesting for us in Austria.
Yo, so basically the analysis around police, I'll start with like where I think it's a shared analysis, but I'll start with where I'm coming from specifically. So we know that the police foundation, where they fundamentally came from, was slave catchers, right? They were like literally militias that were running around the South and snatching up runaway slaves to bring them back to the plantation. And they evolved into, well, maintaining the slave catcher role, but also into Pinkertonism. Like, you know, you work for corporations and so on and so forth, then force their shit, and then, you know, crack strikes. But it seems to me, even with that element added to it, the fundamental thing has stayed the same, which is like slave catching. Because as we like travel through time, we see how like the 13th Amendment was really just gave them a new way to justify slavery, right? Because we know that laws were made around stuff that specifically affected Black folks, specifically Black or even Indigenous folks, like not even, but and Indigenous folks, like specifically was targeting them. It wasn't laws that were like fundamentally there before, but as a target. So it was a way to continue slavery and find legal justification. And we can go into like the Black Codes, and we can go into all those things with, like they were doing to maintain and transition. But when we see police, the whole fundamental thing is to protect one, the image of the state and its investment in slavery, and two, big money and its investment in slavery. You know what I mean? And those are the two things that really set the uphold. And we think a lot of times people will like try to express that the police are here to protect us, but like we even know from like from Supreme Court being like, no, they're not obligated to protect you. So then when you look at it, their interest, what is their interest? Well, it's clearly their fundamental beginning is still their interest today. Even the tactics they use are the same ones they took from slave patrols. Paddy wagons were some of the used in slave patrols. Their star, the gold star, was slave patrol badges. And I think when we see that, we got to understand that it wasn't that it used to be, but it still is just slave catchers. It still is an investment in the prison system, but the prison system is the slave system. So it's still an investment in slavery.
I think the one thing that I would just kind of like add to that conversation about like policing specifically is that I had two things. First, the idea of policing, I think we've tried to get at, is that when we're talking about policing, it's the policing state, not individual police officers or not like local, state, federal police. It's the policing state. So that includes like all the inventions of the state as well too. So policing is much larger and much more encompassing than most people typically think of. And then if you wanted to mention specifically police officers, as BP well stated, it's not what policing does. It's never meant to protect people. It's never meant to keep people safe. Policing has always been about one thing and one thing only. It's intricate connection with capitalism and its connection with the dehumanizing and devaluing of human bodies and life. And like, for me, the greatest example of that, or not even the greatest, just the most apparent and recent example of that is the Breonna Taylor case that I think has probably gone pretty global, but the failure to prosecute, and this isn't about like what accountability or policing or like what should happen in terms of like the court process, but just the stark example that rather than prosecuting some officers who kill somebody, the only actual charge was about the destruction of property, which gets at what policing really does. It protects property, and more specifically, it protects the state. So it's never been about people. And that's kind of my simple take.
I would also add that like what you were saying about dehumanization, it's more like turning us into commodities. And so like when you see Breonna Taylor, you can see how they talked about her as a commodity, right? Oh, she's done. Like it's a broken, like a person's a broken toaster or something. You know what I mean? Like it's like, yo, what the fuck? But like it's really fundamental within their system. And that's where it goes into like there's also no such thing as a good cop. You can't have a good slave catcher. It doesn't make any sense, you know what I mean? And it's because it's not their individual feelings. It's not their individual thought. It's what their collective role is and what that means about them as an individual person. But going into that collective role, because like you, like it's like saying like to me, was there a good cop? Like it's like saying there's a good Nazi. Like it doesn't make sense. It just doesn't. Like yo, yeah, they might have done all these nice things, but like also we go to the Nuremberg trials. They did all these nice things. But they were evil ass people. And I think the same thing comes with the police. They don't, and I get it, police don't realize how bad they are, but it's not our problem to like sympathize with their ignorance. You know what I mean? So
the police are literally the bleeding edge of the carceral state, judge, jury, and executioner, with no accountability, no reprimands, et cetera, right? Like, and I think at least in the U.S. context, a lot of movement energy, sort of a critique of a movement more broadly, a lot of movement energy gets sucked up in, okay, police officer kills a Black person, and then all the movement energy goes into, we got to get that police officer fired, we got to get them prosecuted. It's entirely focused on the individual officer, and guess what? rarely ever gets fired, much more rarely ever gets prosecuted, right? You got the case of Breonna Taylor. They only prosecuted the dude for shooting, for the bullets that missed Breonna, for the bullets that went into the neighboring apartments. That's the only thing they prosecuted her for, right? So if we come from this individual analysis of like, oh, it's not all police, it's just a few bad apples, you're completely missing how the entire roots of the system are rotted and need to be torn out. It's not just the police, it's also the fucking prosecutor. It's also the prisons. Like,
the courts.
The courts, yeah. We can waste our time trying to get quote-unquote justice by getting an officer fired, getting an officer prosecuted. One, it's a waste of energy because we just know that's not going to happen in the vast majority of cases. But two, that's not justice. Justice is if there was never a police there to shoot her in the first place, right? Justice is the complete dismantlement of the carceral state, the prisons, the police, the courts, and the transitioning of those resources into our own communities so we can one day live in a world in which we don't have to worry about our Black, our Indigenous, our poor comrades being gunned down in the street, right, by this bleeding edge of the state. So, yeah, that's just my little rant.
I want to add some on that. Like, when we talk about the, you said, I like you said prosecution of police, because it's really interesting how, like, the dynamics in the streets played out, right? People acting like we need to be more non-property destructive and non, like, all that type of shit. They say non-violent, but it's kind of ridiculous. But what's crazy to me is, like, all the prosecuted cops had only came and came the quickest when people were burning down precincts and cop cars and were fighting back. Then they wanted to prosecute every cop and hold them accountable for all the F's, because it was like all these cops went up on charges right when that was happening. But it's funny, as soon as that started slowing down, how all them charges started getting dropped. You know what I mean? And it's like, we need to like lose these illusions of like that they have some type of moral that they understand. Like, I think Malcolm said it a long time ago, the only language they speak is violence. And I don't even think what was happening was violence, but the only language they speak is the language they're showing us. And if we act like we're going to like peacefully march it out of them, they don't have a conscience to like win over. They don't care. They don't give a damn. And I think when we see that, we see the really like nature of them. But I just want to add that on there, because I feel like that was a really big thing I noticed with what just happened now with the uprisings. I noticed how the dynamics were in the streets when I was out there, and how like how that played out versus like what people were saying like after the original initiation of like we need to be like more peaceful and more like just protest was actually a counter to what we needed to be doing. The high intensity resistance that was happening at the beginning is what caused them to want to actually act. But the thing is, that's clearly the only thing that causes them to want to act. When they start losing capital, when they start feeling like their interests are about to, their whole business are about to burn, then they start to be like, okay, well, shit.
Riots get results.
Facts.
All right, then, ideas of transformative justice and community accountability, something that you sort of work with and relate to? Mm-hmm. As alternatives to the like current carceral state?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about the idea of accountability over the past couple months. And like, we currently exist within political and socioeconomic context in which there is no accountability, right? Accountability that we might have and this idea of community that we might be accountable to doesn't really exist under the conditions of like neoliberal capitalism, because our communities are actively destroyed, right? And so for me, when I'm thinking about accountability, I think, you know, we quite often use it in almost sort of like a punitive sense or like a scary sense. It's like, oh, I fucked up, I need to be accountable for it. And I think that's sort of the wrong approach to begin thinking about accountability, right? I think we need to begin crafting an idea of accountability that situates us within a few different things, and coming at it from sort of, you know, sense of grace, a sense of gratitude, etc. It's like, oh, these are the folks I am accountable to, and I'm gonna like measure my work against that and measure my behavior against that, so I can be, you know, the best organized, the best activist, you know, the best person that I can possibly be within this. And I think for me, it comes back to sort of five different metrics of accountability. Is one, we're accountable to our ancestors, right? We need to situate ourselves within the historical struggles in which they existed, in which they fought, or if your ancestors did some fucked up shit, you need to be accountable to that shit and really work through and process it, right? So we need to be accountable to our ancestors. We need to be accountable to, in an organizing context, those most directly impacted, right? We can't go beyond some saviorism bullshit and be like, oh, hey, all these incarcerated folks, we're here to save you. We're just not going to talk to you, though. Like, nah, that's no, don't do that. That's bad. You've got to actually build relationships with folks that are most directly impacted with the struggles that you're doing and struggle alongside them, not for them, right? Accountable to ancestors, accountable to those most directly impacted, accountable to the movement more broadly. Who are the folks you're in contemporary struggle with, and what does it mean to be in struggle with each other? And not only accountable to the movement more broadly, accountable to the crew you're working with locally, directly, right? Who are your comrades on the ground that you throw down with day in and day out? And how do you know you're being accountable to each other? How do you know you're supporting each other? How do you know you're building an organization that operates outside of the normal way that capital, white supremacy, patriarchy tells us we have to operate with each other? We're not here to build extractive organizations. We're here to build liberatory organizations. And if our organization is destroying our soul and causing us harm, how the fuck can we build a world that isn't going to do that when the very organizations we're in trying to do that can't support ourselves? And I'm drawing a little bit from Adrienne Marie Brown's talk and work around liberatory relationships in that. And like the part reflects the whole, right? And then five, we got this from our comrade Kai, Black Futures Collective, when we were talking through this on a workshop a while ago, but accountable to the earth itself. How is our organizing, how is our work accountable to beyond just humanity, but to like the trees and the grass and the sky and the plants and the animals? How is it accountable to the very ecosystem that keeps us alive and breaks down the barriers we've built between us and the natural world? And so I think if you begin like approaching accountability from those sort of five interrelated metrics, you can then begin to really see, oh, I'm accountable to a lot of people. I can't just go do some fuck shit. Like I gotta really like situate myself and think through how is it I'm approaching movement work, and if I mess up, like here's the people, here's how I can check in and be like, okay, I need somebody to hold me down. I need, maybe it's the local crew that can hold me down. Actually discussing and developing that support network around accountability if you mess up or something, because we all mess up. The point of abolition isn't this fairy tale world, right? Where there's no harm, or there's nothing bad will happen. No, like, we're humans, we're gonna screw up. The point is knowing we're gonna screw up and figuring out plans to address that harm in the long run, in the short term, without the state, without police, without prisons. Yeah, and then, you know, also working on healing that intergenerational trauma that is a result of these hundreds of years of death and genocide brought on by capitalism, by settler colonialism, imperialism, etc. That was a long one. That was a long one. Anybody else want to say it?
I mean, I'm going to come from a little different side of what I thought the question was asking. So I think one of the things is like when we're trying to build like a world without prisons, for example, I think a lot of people think we want like, we need a answer, right? But I just completely disagree with that, because not a answer for any specific thing, because in my mind, I think it's empowering individual communities collectively empowering each other, really, because our individual community, but also like how we support other communities around us, right? But to be able to have their own spaces and answers, because the context is important. The context of communities can be very different. I think to think about like accountability, it has to be within the context. I think it gets harder and harder as time goes on right now, because we have to rebuild a community. The gentrification, for example, is one weapon of destroying communities, right? So then when you get communities now, a lot of times we get like toppled together people that from all these different backgrounds and all these communities that don't have shared context. I think that's what also comes with the ancestors, but not just ancestors like individually, but like also collectively where you're from and the community you had when you were growing up, those type of things. And the context you come from is really important on that, which I think a lot of times now we have to figure out how to rebuild from scratch, because I think at least through my life, I'm seeing my community like thrown to the wind, you know what I mean? All across the world, whether they're in prison, whether they're on drugs, or whether they just move the fuck away, just get away from that, you know what I mean? And I think we have to think, oh, how those communities exist now, or what communities we're trying to build. I think a lot of times we're going to have to build communities. I think community is essential to being able to abolish prisons in a successful way and have a safe world, because the individual society is not going to produce that. But individual society is the society that produced prisons and the society that produced policing and society that produced those divisions in the first place. So we got to pull away from that, but we're going to have to be intentional, but also aware, because I think common background still does matter. And then when there is a common background, a lot more understanding, especially aiming downwards, is really crucial in building a new like world that we can actually, and what I mean aiming downwards is like the more pressure people face, like materially, the more people should like, you know, we should put more empathy and patience aiming downwards. The more trauma people carry, people should have more grace. The more privilege people carry, the less they should have that, because the more they should have, like, no, you just haven't had to deal with your shit, and that's why it's like that. Versus people who have tons of trauma, have hella trauma to deal with, and there's a lot of reasons why they navigate. So I think it's that. We think that's where the accountability conversation comes in. I think, like, again, yeah, we got to move away from the punitive understanding of accountability, but also we need to keep the ability to actually hold people accountable when they don't want to be held accountable. Everybody's going to want to be held accountable. And also, like, there's a lot of lines to that. So it's like a big thing, and it's really individual, I think. Like, not individual, but it's collective, but like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, localized. Like, it's specific off those communities that are around, because we're not going to have a universal answer. I think a universal answer is part of how we got into this problem. And universal answers only generally serve those people who are in power anyways. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was just looking at the clock and noticed that we've already nearly been talking about an hour. not nearly. So I don't think that I'm going to ask all the questions that I still have left. Maybe I picked two that I'd be really interested in. The first one is that you've now given some examples of the campaigns that you work on right now. Sort of, is reformism and abolition for you a dualism? Sort of, is it a contrast for you to do campaigns right now, maybe, that directly support folks inside of prisons? Or do you always situate the reforms that you do in an abolitionist bigger framework? So that's the first question. And then the second one, which you've already sort of answered right now, would be an ending question of what are your visions or your alternatives if you sort of reach abolition? I don't know if that's a great way to pose the question, but I think you get the idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll go with the first one real quick. Yeah, is it a dualism, reformist campaigns versus abolitionist campaigns? Critical resistance has sort of developed and pioneered this helpful distinction between quote-unquote reformist reforms and non-reformist reforms. Reformist reforms being reforms that inevitably strengthen the carceral state, right? Body cameras for police, that puts more money in police budgets, puts more tech on them. That's a reformist reform, right? What are some other examples, Richard?
Body cameras, more police training, just ending cash bail by itself, although that can be complicated for sure. Anything that, electronic monitoring, reforming parole and probation systems, This any campaign, other things? Oh, go ahead, my bad, Jordan. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, this campaign in Alabama right now, the governor's trying to build three new mega prisons as a quote unquote reformist reform for a federal investigation that showed the entire Alabama prison system is corrupt as hell and horribly traumatic and destructive to the folks inside it. Instead of addressing any of those things, the governor was like, let's build three new mega prisons so I can line the pockets of my friends. And my campaign donors, CoreCivic. And so, yeah, these are examples of like shit we don't fuck with.
Yeah, anything like so like for it's it really BP mentioned something in their discussion just about like accountability being localized. The same thing kind of or like that process and how that goes through is localized. The same thing kind of happens based on like the type of reforms like versus abolition work that we do. That's also very localized too, in terms of what are the strategies that what are the strategies and the tactics or things that we support that lead to that gets us closer to what we want in our abolitionist vision versus those things that don't. So for like me in Texas, I probably support stuff. Like the air conditioning stuff is probably a good example of something that's an abolitionist reform or that isn't necessarily going to be a major point in another area. Like BP might say, nah, F all that. We're going to go strictly with abolishing every part and aspect of the prison system. So that might be the organizing that they do in Seattle because they progress the points where where they're able to fight that battle at that level. But in a state like Texas, and it's other states too, I'm involved in things that any reforms that I'm involved with have to not enhance the system and they can't reify the system of oppression. And the things that we do choose to work for at the have to improve the material conditions of incarcerated folks. So if it's a reform I personally would fight types of prisons in Texas. We work with certain ministry groups and things like that that provide material aid for incarcerated folks and just different organizations that are more concerned on that level. But at the same time, those are the things that like those are like when if I think something or if like the collective of folks think that whatever happening isn't improving the lives of incarcerated folks and isn't getting us closer to abolition, there are definitely a lot more groups that we don't support on that level.
I think this gets towards sort of the distinction is what you're working on, distinction between reformist reform, non-reformist reform, is what you are working on going to expand or contract the punitive ability of the carceral state, right?
Acts, yeah,
Is
reducing the
it
scope
going
and power in the
to
state.
create more prison beds? Is it going to create more power with which guards, COs, et cetera, police can yield? And so like the air conditioning thing is an interesting example because it's gonna, 75% of prisons in Texas don't have air conditioning. These are brick and concrete buildings. And we're from Texas. I'm from Texas. Richard's lived in Texas a long time. It gets very, very, very hot in the summer. Over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, I think 32 Celsius. I'm not sure. Y'all need to help me with the conversions. That might be low, 32 Celsius. But yeah, this is going to cost a shit ton of money, right? In order for the state to actually provide air conditioning for prisoners. And part of the like aspect of that we're working on is air conditioning can be used as a weapon against prisoners, right?
Facts.
Guards can, if they want to, crank that down super low and freeze people out, so you have the opposite problem. So part of like engaging with that nuance between reformist reform and non-reformist reform is, okay, our folks need air conditioning. Like, it's fucked up to, like, in the here and now, not provide support for folks inside. Like, we're not going to abolish the 136 prisons in Texas tomorrow, and we've got tens of thousands of people suffering and dozens dying from heat strokes every day without this air conditioning. So how do we go about getting the air conditioning without turning it into just one more weapon?
Yeah. The one thing I wanted to add to that really quick, Jordan, just on the air conditioning one, like, some of the folks that we've worked, that we've been working with, part of like, what is written into like legislation or what they're getting to do in terms of like getting a bill passed about it, it's to actually reduce the number of prisons so that they have more money to pay for conditioning at other facilities. So like this process, I'll give a very quick rundown of the process. So in order to get air conditioning to certain facilities, it's going to it's a step-by-step process. So it won't happen all overnight. So they plan on doing, or so our proposal is they do it in stages. So the stages would be first by targeting specific facilities where there are many complaints and getting a form of central air conditioning. But in that same space, closing down other prisons so that it's more financially feasible to provide other facilities with air conditioning. And that's kind of what's been written into the bill that they want to present towards Texas legislators.
I think like a big thing real quick that needs to be fought, and this is especially across Europe as well, is the idea of, you know, building newer, greener, more environmentally friendly, rehabilitative, quote unquote, prisons, right? And we're fundamentally opposed to that, right? We don't need new prisons. We don't need shinier prisons. We don't need greener prisons. We need less people in the prisons. We need less prisons, right? The solution to bad conditions, to all this stuff, isn't to build more cages, which typically have, new prisons typically have many more beds that can fit people in them than the old prisons just across the board, right? But also, like, if you build it, it will get filled. There's also a lot of arguments in the U.S. about overcrowding. If you build the prison, it's going to get filled. And quite often, they're not going to close the old one that was the argument for the new one in the first place. They're just going to use that as more overcrowding and overflow space. Yeah.
Yep, that means more law and order bills.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was just reading that Richard has to go. Thank you so much for talking to us. Then I think we're maybe trying to come to an end as well. Maybe the last question of your about your vision or your alternatives to the current carceral state.
You got PP?
I mean, I guess, it goes back to what I was saying a little bit earlier about like having to be like individual to each community, because like you gotta know the people. Like, in reality, to have actual accountability, the people have to know each other, they have to understand each other's history, they have to have root. It gets complicated, and there's never gonna be a perfect answer because it's not a perfect world, but I think in the end of the day, is like one of the things that is, the prison is the worst answer. It is gonna have the worst results. It leads to, like, well, first off, it is a form of violence, and then it does lead to more violence, traumatizing people that are already traumatized, more so, putting them in cages and abusing them does not, like, solve the situation in any way. I think, individually, I think that it'll change between communities, because I think communities have different expectations and different, like, boundaries, and they're going to have to work within their context. So that's what I was, like, talking about earlier, but I have, like, one answer. The answer is, like, building communities and having, like, thing. And then one of the big answers, we talk about like what's happening right now and how to deal with what's happening right now is making sure people have the resources they need, because most crimes are over resources. That's just off the top. And when so if we start handling like poverty and we start handling the fact that people got food or housing, crime will start to just in itself like disappear. If we decriminalize things like drugs and the drug war, crime will start disappearing. There won't be crime. And they're not saying there'll never be things that happen that will have to be dealt with, but it won't be anything that could justify an industry, you know? And I think as far as those things that need to be dealt with regardless, I think those are things that, like I said, is individualistic within the communities to figure out how they're going to address it. And I think supporting communities to be able to have the resources to do those things is much more effective than enslaving and traumatizing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when you really like get down to it, an abolitionist is like, we need to develop an abolitionist imagination, right? Is like the things that exist in the here and now feel like they've always existed, but they haven't. Nation states, empires, they've all fallen and historically have fallen, every single last one of them. And so the here and now feels very permanent, but in reality, it's not. And in reality, we need to reshape reality. We need to reshape what is possible. How do we build a world in which we can meet our needs and like protect and build up our communities without the police, without prisons? I think in order to do that, in order to like really get to sort of an abolitionist imagination of what the world could be, it's going to require the ending of capitalism, the ending of white supremacy and whiteness as a concept, the ending of settler colonial states, all these institutions of deep-rooted violence, genocide, et cetera, that are actively destroying our communities, like BP was saying. Like, we got to end those things. We got to actually build up communities again and recreate those deep-seated trust and bonds at, you know, a grassroots level, if we're going to have any hope of being able to overcome all of this and create sort of an abolitionist world. So, you know, just a little long-term struggle that we're going to need to engage in.
Yeah, I think I just want to add that I think they're really important to realize that it's going to be experimental, right? We're going to have to try, fail, and try. Because we can, like, theorize. Like, I come up with a million possible answers to a million possible problems, right? But you don't know how that's actually going to turn out until you actually deal with those problems. And I think we can't, like, I don't want to pretend like we got some miracle answers, because there is a miracle answers. We just know that to get to the point where we're going to have answers that are in any way actually productive and good for people and community, that we're going to have to like change what we're doing. And we're going to have to try and fail and try again. I mean, we see it happen all the time with restorative circles. We see it happen all the time. Like, now, whether they work out good or not, that's all for debate right now. But like, when it comes down to it, I think one of the reasons that a lot of times they don't is because a lack of community, which I think is going to be, it's going to be a first. I think we're going to have to intentionally build it in ways that like make sense and build communities in the ways that make sense. Because of, at least in the United States and in Seattle, for example, or just what I've seen of this country, I think because they've been so taken away, we're going to have to intentionally rebuild those to be able to have a space where we're going to have a world where we can hold people accountable in real ways. I think that's like part of the long journey too, is how we rebuild community from pretty much scratch, from being scattered everywhere, you know?
And yeah, like that's what I keep coming back to, is one of the biggest things that we need to begin shifting our movement work towards is, you know, what I call revolutionary infrastructure. How do we develop and carve our own spaces outside of capital, outside of the state, in which we can imagine and experiment with all of these new possibilities of community? We can figure out how to feed our folks, house our folks, provide healthcare, et cetera, outside the state, outside capital, outside of these punitive measures that are used to just control and destroy us in the interest of capital. Think of all the worlds that we could begin creating in the here and now.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the interview, for talking to me, for us. It was really great.